It was the first year of rabbinical school, maybe the first week or two, when I saw in the hall Professor Eliezer Shlomovic, who was renowned for the depth of his learning and the breadth of his culture and the number of languages he spoke. And he wasn't teaching the first year, so I had to decide, how do I get him to notice me? Yes. Afraid so. So I thought, you got to ask a question. And I happened to be reading a book that had a German expression, and I had actually taken a year of German in college, which I think of as one of the worst experiences of my life. Learning only in the course of the year two things. One was how to say, ich bin ein Berliner. And the other was that Mark Twain said that the German language was a bad excuse for spitting at people. So I thought, but Professor Shlomovic speaks a fluent German, so I came up to him and I said, Professor, my name's David Wolpe, and I'm a first-year rabbinical student, and I'm reading this book. And it has the expression, noch einmal. What does noch einmal mean? And he said, once again. And I said, what does noch einmal mean? And he said, once again. And I thought, the poor man is somewhat elderly. Probably does not hear that well. And in a true who's on first moment, I said, Professor Shlomovic, what does noch einmal mean? And recognizing that there was something wrong with the first years, he said to me, noch einmal means once again. I was completely humiliated to this day. But I realized that there's just a hair's breadth between hubris and humiliation. That a moment of majesty and a moment of abjection, of humility, they're never more than a second apart. They are, in fact, constituent in some ways of the same experience as they are always of the same person. You see it in this morning, in the Torah reading, when we read about the Tower of Babel, when human beings decide, okay, we're going to build a tower to the sky. And that's the exact moment that God decides to destroy the tower. And if you think about it, not in terms of its political or its social implications, but in terms of the dynamics of the individual, what does that mean? That at the moment that you ascend, that you reach a peak, you both fear, anticipate, cover up, and sometimes experience the absolute crumbling that leaves you, as the generation of the Tower of Babel, unable to communicate one to the other, steeped in your aloneness and understanding your finitude, the fact that you are mortal at the very moment that you felt transcendent. This theme is not only a theme that repeats itself in the Torah, it repeats itself in our lives. Moments of exaltation and anxiety alternate constantly. And each one feels so completely authentic that it is hard at that moment to remember what the other was. You'll recall that Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Psicha said that every human being should carry two pieces of paper in their pocket. One says, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, for me the world was created. He said, and when you feel depressed, take that out and read it. And the other says, Afar ve'efer, I am dust and ashes. And when you're feeling on top of the world, take that one out. But I think it is true that you carry them both with you because they're both always true. that polarity that defines the way we walk through the world. And sometimes we get captured by either the insatiability of ego or the collapse of the self inside ourselves, but they're both there. Majesty and humility. Awe at oneself and awe at one's insignificance. I thought about this again yesterday when I had the opportunity to have lunch with a man some of you know, Dr. Neil Martin, who's the head of neurosurgery at UCLA. I went there because he had operated on me twice, and having had two brain surgeries, I thought it would be really nice to have him look at the outside of my head and to be able to talk to him. And because the neurovisionary ball, which UCLA is having, has a bunch of honorees, of which I am one because I survived two neurosurgeries and because at least 51% of the congregation thinks I did so with my brain intact. I know. But he started to show me the slides of what they're doing and what they can now do with brains, with mapping, with understanding which part of the brain controls which part of speech, of vision, with electrical impulses, with different kinds of functional MRIs. And your first reaction is exactly that of the psalmist. Long before any of this was possible, I am awesomely, wonderfully made. A rush of the majesty of the human form, the marvel of the human mind, appreciation for what human beings have created on their own to treat themselves. It's astonishing. And then you realize that it takes the slightest glitch to throw everything into darkness. That a small injury, that an unexpected growth turns you from one sentence in your pocket to the other. From I am in the image of God to I am dust and ashes. And you can't live with only one. Because when your ego inflates, you know inside there's an emptiness. And when you feel depressed and down, you know, at least intellectually, that there have been times when you have felt joy and love and possibility and seen beauty. We live with this polarity in every part of our lives. You can't be creative without having discipline. Creativity without discipline is like a blender with its top off. Things may ferment, but they won't come to anything. There has to be a frame around the picture. There has to be a recognition of the limits of human beings in order to have an expression of our limitlessness. And again, we are reminded of this. I remember many years ago, I was in Israel having a dialogue with Avraham Gord. And someone asked him, why do you wear a kippah? And he said, because I need to remind myself where I stop. And I thought it was a profound comment. That you can only express that which is within you if you understand the frame of the picture. That you can only appreciate the majesty of human beings if you know their nullity. That's why the psalmist in Psalm 8 says, what are human beings that you are mindful of us? Why should you care about us? But you've made us a little lower than angels. Heschel said very beautifully many years ago that the problem with human beings is they think too much of themselves and too little of themselves. We think too much of ourselves because we think we don't need any guidance in this world. We can do anything. We can do everything. And in fact, We do need guidance, and we do need wisdom. And we do need each other, and we do need God. But he said, then they look at the vastness of the universe and they say, we're so small, we're so insignificant, how could God possibly care about us? And then he said, you think too little of yourselves. And so we oscillate between these poles all of our lives, understanding that we can do astonishing things, remarkable things that we can see inside ourselves. And knowing that our time on earth is a brief crack of light between two darknesses, before we were here and after we will be gone. So we root ourselves in memory, in possibility, and in the knowledge that we were modeled on something greater than ourselves. When we read this morning about someone like Noah, we understand exactly what happens to Moses. Remember, there's only one thing that characterizes Moses all through the Torah. The only description of him. It doesn't say Moses was brilliant or Moses was deep. You may get those things from the story, but the only characteristic is Moses was the most humble man who ever lived. It's his humility that is emphasized because his majesty is so great. And when Korach says to him, the job you have taken on is too big for you, Moses doesn't contradict him. He doesn't say, no, it's not. I can handle this. Because it is too big. We all take on jobs that are too big for us. If you have ever raised a child, you've taken on a job that is too big for you. Both in the light way and in the deep way. Who are we to have the fate of another human being in our hands? But we have majesty too. We have insight. We have depth. And we can try. The rabbis tell the story that when God first placed Adam on the earth in the Garden of Eden, nighttime came and Adam had never seen darkness before. And he was terrified and cried out to God. And God pointed him to two stones and said, rub these stones together and you will be able to light the darkness. So Adam took the stones and struck them together and made a spark and created a fire. But the rabbis named the stones. They said one was called Afela and one was called Mavet. One was named darkness and the other was death. Think of the profundity of that legend. That by understanding darkness and death, we make light. That by knowing that we won't be here forever, we make something of the time that we are here. By feeling our humility, we can assert real majesty. All of us. All of us are little lower than angels and little higher than beasts. But in that tremendous continuum of life, the shape of our souls from darkness and death can be majestic and wonderful. As with the generation of the tower, with Noah, with Moses, it's in our hands and in our hearts to make of this brief time a work of goodness, a work of love, a life of art. Shabbat Shalom.